Hello, this is the recording for the course ICP Instrument Techniques for the first lecture of this course. And this will be related to the course held in spring 2025. If you're watching this later on, you can take the other issues as they are, but the schedule will be different in different years, of course. So this schedule that I'm presenting in today's lecture will be mainly focused on 2025 course. But let's get started. I'm going to share my screen so you can see my slides. Let's go to the presenter's view. Okay. Hopefully you can see the correct slide, so you're not seeing the presenter's view, but seeing my slides in full view. Yeah, I hope it's working. Okay. My name is Siiri Perämäki. I'm a lecturer of this course. I've been doing this for 5 years, this course, and this is the first year in 2025 that we are doing this in English. We changed the language from Finnish to English this year, so this is the first year I'm doing this in English. I'm a senior lecturer here at the University of Jyväskylä. I work with circular economy related projects and with analytical chemistry, mostly related to these ICP techniques. I've been using these instruments for over 10 years, so they are very familiar to me, close to my heart, of course. So this is one of my favorite topics that we are talking about in this course and today. Yeah, you can contact me via email if you need to ask anything about this course, or come see me at my office, Applied Chemistry, room 514. So I'm there at mo in most days, but email reaches me best, I would say. So welcome to the course. So how to complete the course? The materials can be found in Moodle, so you can find them there. We have slides, recordings, and how to prepare solutions, so basically calibration solutions for ICP. So they are available. We have four exercises during this course. You should return them to Moodle by the given return date. You can find those also in Moodle, and I'm going to show them to you in the next slide. I will be giving you model answers after the return date, so you will know if something went wrong or you weren't sure how to do those exercises correctly, or you are having questions about them. So I would suggest you take a look at the model answers, even though you think you did them correctly, because they have lots of additional information also, the model answers. So please check them out after completing the exercises. We have a home exam. You will plan an analysis for ICP OS. You need to get 50 out of 100 points to pass the exam. And I will be giving the home exam to you later on. So this will be at the half point of the course. Then we have a group work at the end of the course. It includes a literature summary and presentation about a coupled technique. And what a coupled technique means, that when we have ICP instrument, we can attach it to another instrument, for instance, chromatography instrument, HPLC or GC, and then we can do different analysis with this instrument. So if we attach another different instrument to ICPs, that's what the coupled technique means. I have 10 different options for you from which you can choose. You can form groups, small groups, and choose your topic and present the results. But we will take a more closer look at this at the when we progress with the course. Lectures will be given on Tuesdays, basically on ICP theory, practicals, focusing quite a lot on how to ensure that we get reliable results, which is the most important thing when considering analytical chemistry. It's not just pressing a button and measuring and getting some kind of value. We want to make sure that we are getting correct results, reliable results. And we will be having one or two guest lecturers during the course. So our alumni telling what they are doing currently, they are working in, when they are working in companies, how are they using analytical chemistry? Are they using ICP techniques and so on? I haven't confirmed them yet, but I will let you know as soon as they are confirmed. Then we have a exercise clinic, so we will be doing together the exercises, these four exercises on Thursdays, and you can ask questions, any questions related to the course. So this is quite an informal gathering. So anything you need about the course, you can ask, and I will try to answer your questions and try to help you with the course. Then we have ICP demonstrations, one for each instruments that we are looking at during this course. So ICP OES, one demonstration, and one demonstration for ICP MS. Approximately 2 hours is one demonstration, and this is just that you get to know the instrument, get some hands-on experience, and this will be done in groups, small groups, maybe 5 people. And I will be putting the times in Moodle, and you can book an appropriate time for yourself in Moodle later on. I will move my bar here so I can see my slides. Okay, so the course timetable, first part of the course is related to elemental analysis and ICP OES technique. So we will be looking at that for the first few weeks. We will be doing the exercises also. And after the 3rd week, you will have the home exam return date. And also the guest lecturer is planned on the 3rd week of the course. Then we will move on to ICP MS technique, and we will start the demonstrations with ICP OES and then ICP MS. They are marked, the demonstrations are marked here on week 16 and 18, but they will probably span a little bit more than 2 weeks because we have so many students, the course is full. We will have lots of demonstration groups, so I will have to span the demonstrations a little bit more than 2 weeks, so to fit into my schedule and also, of course, your schedules also. After the demonstrations, when the ICP-MS demonstrations are done, we will have 2 seminar days when you will present your group works. And then the literature summary return date is on 11th of, is this April? No, May, sorry, May, 11th of May. Yeah, Okay. Slides are not moving. Okay, now they are moving. Okay, so course content, what we are looking at. We will take a look at the basics of elemental analysis and ICB-OES. So some ICB theory and some basic information about trace element analysis. So how to measure low concentrations of elements is what we are looking at. In Finnish, it's hivenaineanalytiikka. I'm mentioning some terminology also in Finnish if they are like specific terms that you may not know. Then we are looking at how does the ICB-OES instrument work, how to select sample introduction system and operating conditions. We're looking at sample matrix, how to prepare solutions, how to adjust spectral peaks, possible interferences and their correction. Then, of course, interpretation and presentation of results is an important thing. Basically, the same thing for ICB-MS. So we will be taking a look at the operating principle, uses and special requirements for ICB-MS. So they are similar techniques. The ICB part is the same, but the detector is different. And for that reason, they are having some differences in requirements for both instruments. Yeah, then we will take a look at the learning outcomes after the course. I hope that you will be able to know what the ICB instruments can be used for, so you know the applications, what they are capable of. You're able to plan an analysis for both of these instruments. You can verify the reliability of the results, so you know that you are getting a correct result from the instrument. You are not getting some kind of value and running with it, but you know that your result is reliable. You know the basic operating principles of both instruments. You know the most important interference sources and how to remove these. Then I would like to emphasize that the analysis is a lot more than just running the sample with ICB. So the stages of an analysis consist of sampling, transport, maybe storage, pretreatment, then the ICB analysis in this case, or maybe some others also, other analysis, and then interpretation of results, and then reporting. So actually the analysis is very small part of this process, and all parts of these all stages of the process need to be known and carefully considered when we are doing an analysis and planning an analysis. And the best ideal case is when the analyst and the person who is taking the samples, they are working together, they are collaborating, they are planning this, how to do it together. So the person who is doing the analysis knows how the sample is taken, knows how it's being stored, and so on. This course will focus on the analysis part. We have other courses also which are focusing mainly on the different stages of the analysis. So CHEMS 3240 is focusing, it's in Finnish only, it's focusing on the sampling pretreatment steps. They are discussed in that course a little bit. And then reliability of the results, statistical analysis for the results, they are in CHEMS 3040, which is currently ongoing actually. Similar to this course, it's ongoing at the same time as this ICP course in spring 2025. And so this course is basically dealing with pretreatment analysis and interpretation, because these pretreatment and interpretation are so vital parts of the analysis. I have included some material about this also into this course. And the most important thing is that the analyst knows how the sample has been taken, knows the previous stages of the analysis to ensure the reliable results. So if you get a sample and you know nothing about it, it's very difficult to get reliable results, and it will require a lot more work to do the analysis. And if mistakes have been made prior to the analysis, so in the sampling or transport and storage steps, the analysis results will not be accurate. You cannot correct the results anymore if mistakes have been done in previous steps. So that's why it's very important to think about the whole analytical process when doing analysis. Okay, then I will give you a little bit of exercise to work on. I have some basic vocabulary of analytics here. I would like for you to stop the recording and think about how many of these do you know, and think about what they mean in relation to analytical chemistry. Do you know what they are? Oh, actually, I have the ICPs written down there already. Sorry, I translated this. Might have been in a bit of a hurry. So actually, I think I have the ICPs already there. But yeah, you can consider the others, what they are, and do you know some of these? Take your time and get back to the recording when you are done. Yeah, hopefully you have taken your time to think about this. So we will take a look. What is the analyte? It is a component that is being analyzed. So it can be an ion, element, compound, any substance that is being analyzed. I use this word often, so it's just something that is being analyzed, is the analyte. Qualitative, it's information about quality, identification of the analyte. So if we have qualitative analysis, we know that there is the compound or the analyte is present, but we don't know its concentration. Compared to quantitative information, quantitative analysis, we will measure the amount or concentration of the analyte in the sample. So it's information about quantity. So you can tell it by the words even. So they are about quality. Qualitative analysis is about quality, and quantitative information is, telling about the quantity of the analyte. Then sensitivity, it's regarded as the instrument response in relation to the concentration. And what this means is basically that when the concentration changes, if we have a very sensitive instrument, we will get a high response to the changes in concentration. If we have not so sensitive instrument, we will get a small response in relation to the change in concentration. So very sensitive instruments will get high response even though we have very low concentrations. And for the not so sensitive equipment, we need quite a high concentration to get a response from the instrument. ICP-MS is a very sensitive instrument. It's more sensitive than ICP-OVS, if you think about ICP techniques. Linear dynamic range is the concentration region where we are getting a straight calibration line. So the relationship between response and concentration is linear. So it means that the calibration line doesn't curve. And this is where we like to work with ICP techniques in the linear range. Limit of detection. It's defined as the concentration which can be separated from the blank sample. So if we analyze a blank sample, which is a sample containing none of our analyte, so it's basically pure water, some nitric acid perhaps, or deionized water or something like this. If we analyze that, we get some response always, some counts from the instrument, but when we are at the limit of detection, it's higher than the blank, and we know that there is the analyte is present, but we cannot tell the concentration with the reliability. So we can tell, okay, there's analyte, but we cannot say with reliable with much reliability that how much of the analyte we have. But the limit of quantification is a limit where, or a concentration which we can report with sufficient confidence. So this is a concentration that where we exceed this limit, we can report our results. And I will explain in the further or the next lectures how these are determined and calculated. So there are specific routes on how to calculate this for a specific method. And these are, of course, dependent on the instrument, method, calibration range, so on. So you have to determine these for each method separately or each analytical purpose separately. Then ICP-OVS, this is inductively coupled plasma optical emission spectrometer. Sometimes also referred to ICP-AAS, atomic absorption, atomic emission spectrometer, but the more correct term would be optical emission spectrometer. It's more commonly used. ICP-MS, similarly inductively coupled plasma mass spectrometer. Okay, then let's take a look at the zinc calibration line with ICP-OVS. You can see some of the terminology that we just looked at in this example. So this is an ICP-OVS calibration line. We have analyzed a blank sample or a blank solution. So none of the analytes are present, and then three calibration standards. Then we get some kind of intensity for these solutions. We plot them into this into this figure, and we get an equation which gives us the sample concentration for our unknown sample. And we should get a linear fitting here when we are working in a dynamic linear range. So we have a straight line going through those points. I would say that I would like to have another point there, maybe at 600 or 500 micrograms per liter, because there is quite a big difference between the 200 and 1000 micrograms per liter. So the calibration line is not very evenly distributed. So maybe another point there would be beneficial. But in this case, we have only used 3 points. And if we get an unknown sample, when we have an unknown sample, we get some kind of intensity for it. We get some intensity, and then we can see it from the graph that, okay, for this intensity, the concentration is here. And of course, we do it the instrument does it for us by putting the intensity into the equation, and it calculates the sample concentration for us using the calibration line. So this is what a calibration is for. We do a calibration for the instrument, then we analyze the unknown samples. And in this case, we have the LOD, so limit of detection. We can separate this from the blank sample with some confidence that we, and the LOD is in this case 4 micrograms per liter. So this can be differentiated from the blank sample. So we have some analytes if we have 4 micrograms of zinc in our sample. But the LOQ is a value a little bit higher than the LOD. It's 11 micrograms per liter. So when our sample concentrations exceed 11 micrograms per liter, we can say with confidence that, okay, we have this analyte here and this is its concentration. And for this kind of method, we can report the results from the LOQ quantification limit up until the highest calibration standard. So this is our reporting concentration range. So we can report our results within this range, from 11 micrograms per liter to 1,000 micrograms per liter of zinc. Okay. Then I would like to tell you why are the ICPs so common in laboratories, because they have replaced AAS instruments in many laboratories when we are analyzing several elements from the samples. And this is because of the multi-element analysis capability of the ICPs, because if you have analyzed with AAS, you know how tedious it is to analyze one element at a time, change the lamp, and do the same thing again. So if you have a lot of elements you want to analyze, these instruments are a lot more time efficient, is it? They are a lot faster if you need to analyze several elements. If you have one or two elements, it's fine if you are using an AAS instrument. It doesn't require a lot more time, but if you have 20 plus elements, ICPs are very efficient in this case, because they analyze, basically they can analyze the periodic table in a few minutes. So like 70 elements in a few minutes. They are fast, yes. They have low detection limits. In the figure, we have detection limit ranges. For the ICP-MS, it's the most sensitive ICP instrument, as I said, and the detection limits start from 0.1 micrograms per liter for some elements, but they are up to the nanograms per liter for some elements with ICP-MS. So it's a very sensitive equipment. For the ICP-OS, depending on if we are using radial or axial view, don't bother with the terms yet. I will let you know what they mean later on, but we are working with ICP-OS in, let's say, 100 micrograms per liter up to 1 or 0.1 micrograms per liter. So we can see concentrations as low as this, depending on the element. So this is element specific. Some elements are more sensitive, some are less sensitive, depending on the technique and the properties of the element, ionization energy, interferences, so on. They have wide linear range compared to, let's say, the AAS instrument. You need to have a very specific small concentration range with AAS instruments. ICBs can do a lot wider linear range. ICB OS is very cost effective, not so pricey, 30,000-40,000 euros. Not very expensive equipment. ICP-MS can do isotope analysis, so this is one of its good points if you need that kind of special analysis. Of course, these techniques have some challenges as well. So samples need to be in liquid form. This is a requirement that it's not problematic if you have aqueous samples to begin with, you just run them and it's not a big problem. If you have solid samples, you need to pre-treat them in order to get the analytes in solution. So you need to do some kind of acid digestion, for instance, happoliuotus, to get the analytes in the solution. For geological samples, for instance, this can be a time-consuming step and require quite a lot of a special equipment to get these analytes into the solution state. Interferences from other elements present in the sample or from reagents used in the sample pretreatment can cause interferences, and these can be very difficult. So this is a challenging part. ICB-MS has some special challenges. It's relatively high priced, more close to 100,000 euros. needs more expertise when you are doing analysis and especially in the method development stage. And if you have some interferences in that case also. Limitations in sample matrix are present more in the ICB-MS than with the ICB-OS. So there is a limit for dissolved solids present in the sample and organic matter, which can be a little bit restricting. Then we will take a look at the main principles of a reliable analysis. What do you need to have to get good results? The analysis needs to have an agreed purpose. So if you are doing analysis for industrial process control, regulatory requirements or research, your analysis will have a completely different requirements. So for industrial process control, probably high speed, high reliability is needed because you are controlling the process with this analysis. So if you are making mistakes or your analysis will be slow, you will have big problems in the process, and this can be very costly. Regulatory requirements. So in Finnish, lainsäädännölliset vaatimukset. If you have some requirement that, for instance, your lead concentrations in your effluent water or your wastewater needs to be like 3 micrograms per liter, needs to be less than 3 micrograms per liter, you need to reach that reach that limit. It's very important to get reliable analysis in this case. Research, we are doing analysis for research here at the university. Here the speed is not an issue in most cases. Usually it doesn't matter if our analyses are 1 or 2 days slower. If we are postponed for 1 or 2 days, it doesn't make a big deal in most cases. But if you are considering industrial process control, this can be a very, very challenging issue to have delays in your analysis. And the analyst must always know the purpose of the analysis, and always if the purpose changes, there might be different requirements for the analysis if you change the purpose that you are doing the analysis for. So this is very important collaboration and communication issue. So if you have a customer who is using the results for some kind of purpose, if the purpose changes, you must know. Analyses are carried out using tested equipment and methods that are fit for purpose. So as I mentioned, if you have a lead concentration of 3 micrograms per liter, that you need to verify that your effluent concentration is below that, you need a sensitive equipment that can reach this 3 micrograms per liter detection limit without any hiccups. So you need sensitivity. Then you will need specificity and selectivity. So response only from the analyte. So this is means that your analysis is free from interferences. So you need to verify that you are not getting any interferences in your analysis. Then the measurement range needs to be set appropriately. And this is the concentration range where the method works. And if you exceed this, you will need to do some testing if the method is okay also in the exceeded range. So you cannot exceed this unless you verify that the results are still okay. Robustness is a good a good thing for a method. Means that the method is tolerant to changes present in the environment or in the sample. So for instance, if the sample matrix changes a little bit, you have a acid matrix and it changes a little bit, a robust method will not be affected by this. You're getting the same results even though you have small changes in the sample matrix, or the temperature of the laboratory could change between winter and summer, and this needs to be checked that is this causing a problem. If you have a very robust analysis and method, this will not affect your results. Then about the analyst. The analyst needs to be competent and capable of carrying out the analysis, needs appropriate training and induction, so Finnish perehdytys, työhön perehdytys is induction. Written instructions for equipment and methods is a very important thing. If someone just tells you they are measuring with you for the first time and then they just tell you, okay, do this, but if you don't have it written down, it's very difficult and can cause a lot of problems if you don't have written instructions. Laboratory performance needs to be assessed by an independent body. We can do auditing, external and internal auditing, to check if the method or the analysis is working correctly. So we ourselves, we would have someone check our practices, or then someone coming from outside doing. And this is done in accredited laboratories. How to say it? It's done in accredited laboratories with a certain interval that someone is coming to check your analysis and your procedures and check that everything is working okay. We are not an accredited laboratory, so we don't have external auditing. But this is the case in most analytical laboratories which give out results. So they are giving out results for other people who have their methods accredited. So this is a common practice. Then there is benchmarking programs. This is in Finnish vertailumittausohjelma. And this is done in Finland by SYKE, so the Finnish Environmental Institute, and they are doing it. So what it means is that they have some kind of sample and they are distributing it to even parts and sending it to the participants of this program, and they are analyzing the samples and giving out the results to SYKE, who will be combining a report from this, and then we will compare the results to each other, and hopefully there will be some kind of consensus between the laboratories, between the results. And if there are outliers or some laboratories are outside of the range, then these laboratories can take a look at their procedures if something is wrong with their analysis. So this is basically a comparison between laboratories and the results they are getting. This is a little bit of the same topic. So the analytical results are in line with results obtained elsewhere. We can do inter-laboratory comparative tests. So if we have some other laboratory who is doing similar kind of analysis, we can send the sample and have it tested there. This is not so formal as the previous point. So the independent body is watching our analysis, but this is a little bit more informal. So we can do comparative testing. Also, the use of certified reference material is very, very much a good thing. So this is a very common practice in our laboratories. So the certified reference material are different kind of sample matrices, which are available on stores. You can buy these from VVR or National Institute of Standards and Technology, for instance. And these are samples that come with a reference or a certificate, I mean, and the certificate says, okay, this is your copper concentration, this is your iron concentration, this is your silica concentration, and so on. They have several of these certified elements given, and then you can compare your own results with the certificate. And there's also the reliability of the results given, so the uncertainty present in the analysis. And these certified reference materials have been analyzed in reliable analysis laboratories, several of them, and they have produced a certificate based on that. And there are a huge variety of sample matrices available of these reference materials, and usually there is one that is similar to your own sample, and you should use a certified reference material that is most comparable to your own sample. So if I have a soil sample, I will select a reference material that is the soil sample. There are even different soil reference materials available, so I can select from those. If I'm using sewage sludge as a sample, I will select some kind of sewage sludge reference material. Okay, then one more point. We need to have well-defined control and assurance procedures in place. So we need to do regular calibration or standardization, and standardization means checking our calibration. Then we need to do replicate samples. This means that you are analyzing duplicates of your sample. So you are analyzing the same sample twice, for instance, or three times. How many you would like, you can choose. But usually we do duplicates or triplicates. Then we have control samples. These can be produced by ourselves in our own laboratory, so we can make a control sample which we know the concentration of, and we analyze it with our real samples, and we check that the control sample is within the limits that we are making, that we have made it to be. So if we have 50 micrograms per liter of control sample, we have a copper control sample with 50 micrograms per liter, we are checking that it actually is giving us 50 micrograms per liter when we analyze it. Then we can check the accuracy of the results against previous measurements and monitor control samples. So if we have a, but this case only applies if we are analyzing the same sample again or similar samples again. If we have totally different samples each time, we cannot really check between the measurements. But in a case when we are analyzing similar kinds of samples, we can check the previous data and see if they are in line with each other. And then we need to monitor these control samples. If they are not within the range that we have agreed that we are looking for, we need to make some changes. In commercial laboratories, in industry, they are in many cases using control cards and alarm limits. So if the concentration is starting to increase for some reason in the similar kind of samples, they will have some kind of alarm to check the analysis, make some changes perhaps. So this is what is commonly done in industry, in analytical laboratories, in commercial analytical laboratories. Then I have finally one example before we close this lecture. This is an analysis of plant leaf samples. We got these from, was it from Latvia, I think, or Estonia? I don't remember anymore. This is a few years ago. We had single plant leaves for analysis of iron, manganese, and zinc. We had 8 samples in total. We needed to dissolve these because these were solid samples. We did microwave-assisted digestion for this using a reference material. We had a plant reference material. I think it was tomato leaves in this case. So similar to our samples, we are using a plant leaf reference material. Individual leaves weight from 20 to 200 milligrams, and they were microwave digested using nitric acid and hydrochloric acid. Then we added 2 replicates of the reference material with the same procedure, and 2 method blanks in the same dissolution series. So the method blanks are samples that are the sample pretreatment is done exactly the same for these method blanks as for the real samples, but we are not adding any sample. So if we have a batch of microwave digestion vessels, we put the samples in these ones, add the acids. For these method blanks, we just add the acid, so no sample in them. And exactly the same procedure is done for all of these, for the reference material, for the real samples, and for the method blanks. So we put them in the microwave oven, we do the digestion, then we filter the samples, fill them to mark with ultra pure water. So this is the pretreatment procedure. Only new vessels for used to avoid contamination, because we thought that the concentration is probably quite low in these samples. We did calibration solution for this. We prepared multi-element standards, 1 blank, then 10, 100, and 1,000 micrograms per liter of these elements. And we always use multi-element standards, so we don't prepare individual calibration standards for this because it's very time consuming, but we prepare multi-element standards in most cases, in almost all cases. If the elements are not compatible with each other, then we might do different, like separate the elements into different calibration standards. But this is very rarely. This is a very rare case. So in almost all cases, if you are analyzing several elements, put these elements into the same calibration standards. So use multi-element standard. The same acid background was added into the calibration standards as in the samples, in the real samples. So this is the matrix matching, which we always do with ICP and in most analytical techniques. So our calibration standards needs to have the same matrix as our real samples, and this is to avoid any interferences. I will be talking about this in further, a little bit more in the following lectures also. Okay, then we have the ICP results, and I will let you take a look at these for a little bit, and then consider how are the results looking. Is everything okay? Is there something wrong, perhaps? Should something be done differently? I will just tell about the samples. What is happening in this table? So we have iron, manganese, and zinc, and the concentration is in micrograms per liter unit. The first column has the sample ID, which has been analyzed. So we are first doing the calibration. So always analyze the blank first, then start from the most dilute standard solution or the calibration solution. So standard one, two, and three. They are analyzed. So this is the calibration. Then we are analyzing a blank to see if there's any carryover from the highest calibration solution, highest concentration of the calibration solution, to see if the flush time has been sufficient. So we are analyzing first 1,000 micrograms per liter here to see if the blank is okay. Then we are analyzing these control samples. These have a known concentration of 100 micrograms per liter. It's analyzed here at the start of the analysis and at the end of the analysis also. Then we have these method blanks, should not contain any analyte. Then these S4, S6, and so on, they are the real samples. Then after the real samples, we have ref 1 and ref 2. They are reference materials. So these are the tomato leaves that we analyzed as reference materials, two replicate samples for the reference materials. So these are the reference materials. So you can stop the video here, take a few minutes to consider what is okay, what is maybe not okay, and then we will take a look at the results together. Okay, maybe you have taken a few minutes now, stop the video and started it again. So what is good about the analysis? Let's see. Yeah. Okay, we have analyzed the blank after the calibration. It's looking pretty okay. So up at the highest, we are seeing 4 micrograms per liter for zinc in the blank. It's not very, very high concentration. So it's looking that the flush time is okay. Quality control sample is analyzed at the beginning. It's looking pretty okay, from 97 to 102% of recovery. Or, yeah, considering that what it should be, looking pretty okay. Method blanks are looking pretty low. So they are at the highest. We are seeing 2.5, is it for zinc? Yeah, 2.5 micrograms per liter for zinc. Quite low. Then we have used reference material. This is, of course, a good thing. Then we have confirmed at the end of the analysis that is the control sample still okay. But if you consider this, do you think this is okay? The last control sample, maybe not. It has decreased a little bit. So with ICP instruments, as with many other instruments, we are seeing a drift of the instrument, and usually it means that when we start the analysis, the intensity slowly decreases during the analysis. You can, depending on the case, you can analyze for several hours without any problems with the drift. Sometimes, even in a short analysis, you will see some drift. So your quality control sample is not within the appropriate range anymore. And in most cases, we are considering 10% difference. You can use up to 20 if that's the case, but in most cases, 10 is considered okay, and this is exceeding 10 for zinc. So 87% recovery rate is we are getting for the 100 micrograms per liter control sample. So not so good things about this. Okay, the control is not in the tolerance range. Then if we consider this reference material, it's actually there is quite a bit of difference between the two replicates. So if this was an ideal case, we would get quite similar results because this is the same sample, same reference material. We should get quite similar results for this. So what to do? I would perhaps make more replicates of these reference materials and run them again to see if we find some good average for this reference material. Yeah, then an important thing to consider are the samples in our calibration range. This is something that is too often not considered. I've seen this with students many times that we take the results and yeah, okay, that's fine. But if you consider we have 1,000 micrograms per liter, it's our upper calibration range. It's where our calibration stops. So we know that this is linear up to 1,000 micrograms per liter. But here we are getting results, let's say for S1 for zinc, almost 3,000 micrograms per liter. So this is overshooting the calibration range in a very big way. So this is a result that you should never report. You should always make dilution for this if you are exceeding the calibration, yeah, very much. If it's within 10% of the highest calibration standard, you could still report the result. But for this one, it's three times as high as the highest calibration standard, so it's really not okay. So for those that exceed the calibration range, just do a dilution and run them again. And because the last control sample here, this 100 micrograms per liter, it's not in the appropriate range for zinc, something needs to be done. So perhaps you would recalibrate the instrument, dilute these few samples that were going over the calibration range, and then analyze again those that you have diluted, and also some of the last samples here, because you see the drift is happening at the end of the analysis. So at least I would say five last samples would need to be reanalyzed to see if the drift has caused a problem there. If you are being very strict, if you are working in a commercial laboratory, you would have to, if your control sample is not within the range that it needs to be, you would have to reanalyze all samples since the last control sample that has been okay. So the first control sample. So you would actually need to reanalyze all samples in a commercial laboratory. But it depends on your method, on how you are doing the analysis. But if we are being strict, we would need to analyze all of these again since the zinc concentration is not in the appropriate range in the last control sample. But in research purposes, we would just analyze maybe five of the last samples again. Okay, I think this is my last slide, the end of the first lecture. I'm going to stop the share so I can stop the recording. So thank you for your interest, and I will see you at the next lecture. Bye.